And now, Westwood One presents the Lost Lennon Tapes, brought to you by Snickers. At home, work, or play, Snickers really satisfies. Here's Elliot Mintz.
In this broadcast, we'll take a closer look at the 1968 marijuana bust, which caused John so much trouble later on with U.S. immigration authorities. You'll hear him get down and dirty singing the blues on one of his work tapes. With a little help from John's Aunt Mimi, we're going to find out more about his seafaring father, Alfred Freddie Lennon. And while we're at it, John's going to regale us with a swashbuckling sea story of his own. But to lead off our program, let's flash back to February 1967 during the sessions for what came to be the Beatles' legendary Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band LP. So far, the group had recorded only two songs written by John. The first had been Strawberry Fields, which wound up being lifted from the album for release as a single, and the second, Been a Day in the Life. At that point, John began scrambling to write more material, fearing he'd be underrepresented on the LP. At the beginning of February 67, he came up with another new tune, and while listening to John's tapes, we found the rough, incomplete demo he laid down at home before heading to Abbey Road.
Throwaway piece of garbage, I always thought. It's just not one of my favourite pieces because, you know, at the same time I wrote Mr. Kite and Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds and Day in the Life. So if you line them up against those three, Good Morning doesn't really stand up. So that's why I don't have much of a feeling about it, you know. But it's fun, the kind of the sound effects.
From John Lennon's personal tape collection, his quickie demo for Good Morning, Good Morning, Guh. The first two verses, the chorus, and the middle eight. And we heard the rest of the tune the way it was recorded at Abbey Road in February 1967 by the Beatles' temporary alter ego. Yep, here they are. J.
John's infamous 68 bust in London for marijuana possession.
Why do they need 40 cops to arrest John and Yoko?
Next on the Lost Lennon Tapes. Let's return to the Lost Lennon Tapes.
There were two key reasons the U.S. Immigration and Naturalization Service gave John such a hard time about granting him permanent residency in the States. The first was his October 1968 arrest in London for unauthorized possession of cannabis resin. And the second was his alleged conspiracy with New York-based underground activists like Jerry Rubin and Abby Hoffman to disrupt the 1972 Republican Convention. Such was the paranoia of the Nixon administration. We'll explore the latter situation more deeply in another broadcast. Right now, let's take a closer look at John's first run-in with the law, the bust. On October 18, 1968, a troop of London policemen, accompanied by dogs and reporters, raided the flat at 34 Montague Square. It was owned by Ringo, and John and Yoko were living there temporarily. As a shaken John called Brian Epstein's attorney, the cops, led by a detective named Norman Pilcher, claimed they found 219 grains of cannabis resin, or hashish, in Lennon's basement.
That thing was set up. The Daily Mail and the Daily Express were there before the cops came. He'd called the press. In fact, Don Short had told us they're coming to get you 3 weeks before. So believe me, I'd cleaned the house out because Jimi Hendrix had lived there before in this apartment, and I'm not stupid. I went through the whole damn house.
Pilcher, the cop Lennon says set him up, was the same guy who'd busted Mick Jagger, Keith Richards, and Marianne Faithfull in 1967. Pilcher was also the cop who later busted George Harrison on March 12, 1969. Paul's wedding day, as a matter of fact. Well, Pilcher and his crew informed John and Yoko they were under arrest, the charge being cannabis possession, and because John had protested, Pilcher slapped the charge of obstructing police in the execution of a search warrant on them, just for good measure. Well, the first question asked by a lot of people, including John, was why hadn't he been nailed in a drug charge before then?
Being my friend, I said you called up a robber. Day or night, he'll be there any time at all. Dr. Robert.
Preventing us us getting busted, because, I mean, we were open about it years ago, you know. I mean, it was common knowledge.
It's true that John and the Beatles had been taking stimulants as early as their first trip to Hamburg. And in discussing his Revolver song, Dr. Robert, in the 1980 Playboy interviews, John said he was the one who'd carried the band's pills during those early tours. The Beatles, in fact, had smoked marijuana for the first time in New York in 1964. By the next year, on the set of the Beatles' second movie, Help, during spring and summer 1965, John says,
by then we were smoking marijuana for breakfast at that period, and we were well into marijuana, and nobody could communicate with us because it was just four glazed eyes giggling all the time, you know, in their own world.
And on October 26th, 1965, when the Beatles went to pick up their Members of the British Empire, or MBE, awards, they'd smoked grass in the Royal Loo at Buckingham Palace and gotten away with it. During a 1967 interview, Paul McCartney was asked if he'd ever taken LSD. When he said yes, the media had a field day, even though Paul and later John tried to emphasize they weren't suggesting people rush out and drop acid or take other drugs just because they had. So, as John said earlier, drug use by members of the Beatles was pretty common knowledge by the end of 1968, and even though the band took a lot of heat from the media and others about it, none of the four had ever been arrested on a drug charge. So why did Pilcher and his boys go after John that November and not November 64? Well, less than a week after his conviction, this is how John figured it.
I don't really know the reason why they suddenly busted me now. Probably because they've been waving me flag a bit, I thought.
Everyone had a hard year. Everyone had a good time. Everyone got the boot in. Everyone saw the sunshine. Everyone had a hard year. Everyone let the hair down. Everyone pulled the socks up. Everyone put the foot down. Everyone had a hard year. Everyone put the feet up. Everyone had a face down. Everyone got a new coat. Everyone, everyone. Everyone, everyone. Everyone, everyone. Everyone, everyone. Everyone had a hard year. Everyone had a good time. Everyone got the boot in. Everybody saw the sunshine. Everyone had a hard year. Everyone let the hair down. Everyone pulled the socks up. Everyone put the foot down. Everyone had a hard year. Everyone had a good time. Everybody put the feet up. Everybody got the wrong time. Everybody got the wrong time.
John Lennon, looking back on 1968 with Everybody Had a Hard Year, recorded late in the year while he and Yoko were staying at Ringo's home in Weybridge. In January 69, the song became part of I've Got a Feeling, recorded by the Beatles and released on the Let It Be album. 68 had been a pretty rough year for John and the Beatles, and for reasons far too numerous to list here. But when you add all of them up and consider the era, John probably did have reason to believe they were coming to take him away during the autumn of 68. On October 19, 1968, the day after their arrest, John Winston Lennon and Yoko Ono appeared at Marylebone Magistrates Court in London. They were formally charged with unauthorized possession of cannabis resin and released pending trial on November 28th.
The picture on the back of Life of the Lions, Unfinished Music number 2, is us being dragged out of the police station. It's from newspaper pictures.
Come on, come on. Come on, it's such a joy. Come on, it's such a joy. Come on, take it easy. Come on, take it easy. Take it easy. Take it easy. Everybody's got something to hide except for me and my monkey. Thank you. on, it's such a joy. Come on, it's such a joy. Come on, make it easy. Come on, make it easy. Make it easy. Make it easy. Everybody's got something to hide, except for me and my monkey.
That's John's demo for Everybody's Got Something to Hide, Except Me and My Monkey, the studio version of which appears, of course, in the double LP The Beatles, affectionately known as the White Album.
Cry, baby, cry, make your mother sigh, she's old enough to know better.
Well, at first, John and Yoko tried to shake off the bust and the attendant public spectacle as unpleasant but not unbearable. But on November 21st, the physical and emotional stress John and Yoko were under took their toll. They lost the baby. It was the first of three miscarriages Yoko ultimately suffered. John stayed with her at Queen Charlotte's Maternity Hospital in Hammersmith, London. When he could, he slept in a spare bed. And when that was taken, a cot. The next day, the 22nd, the White Album was released in Britain. And on the 28th, John was back in court, where he pleaded guilty to the possession charge. He was ordered to pay a fine of 150 English pounds and 20 guineas court costs. At the time, that was roughly equivalent to $400.
And the only reason I pleaded guilty, because I thought they'd send Yoko away because we weren't married. And I thought, what's the word? They'd throw her out of the country. So I copped a plea. And the cop said to me, well, we've got you now, so it's nothing personal, yeah.
John figured copping that plea was the path of least resistance. But the following spring, May 16, 1969 to be exact, John applied for a visa to enter the United States, and the Immigration and Naturalization Service denied it, citing the pot bust as the reason. All of a sudden, copping a plea didn't seem like the best way out, after all.
I have a record for life. I have problems getting in countries because this guy busts me. I've never denied having been involved with drugs, but at that particular time, there was a question raised in the House of Parliament. Why do they need 40 cops to arrest John and Yoko?
Let it begin.
running out of money. The king is in the kitchen, making bread and honey. No friends and yet no enemies. Absolutely free. No rats above the magic ship of perfect harmony. Now it begins.
An unreleased alternate mix of Clean Up Time from the Double Fantasy Sessions of Autumn 1980. That December, when John and Yoko spoke with the BBC's Andy Peebles, she said their use of drugs was pretty much a thing of the past.
Yeah, it's just like it's a trip that we went through. But at the same time now, it's Clean Up Time. And we're really sort of like cleaning our bodies and, you know, it's very important that.
Peebles correctly perceived that the arrest 13 years before...
caused you a lot of heartache.
It caused me a lot of heartache, and it still does. So I want to know any legal minds listening. How do I get rid of a record? Because the statute of appeals ran out because I don't have a legal mind, and I went to find out about it at one time because I wanted to get this thing off my record. And they told me, oh, you should have applied within the first 2 years. Well, nobody told me that.
Sleepy Blind Lemon Lennon plays the blues for you.
The blues is better because it's real. You know, you sit on that music.
Next on the Lost Lennon Tapes. Here's Elliot Mintz with more of the Lost Lennon Tapes.
In the port city of Liverpool, John was exposed to lots of different musical styles at an early age.
I grew up with blues music, country and western music, which is also a big thing in Liverpool. One of the first visions I ever have is a fully dressed cowboy in the middle of Liverpool with his Hawaiian guitar. You know, that's the first time I ever saw a guitar in my life. He had the full gear on.
As he got older, John became fascinated by the sounds of black American R&B and rock and roll. But like many other young music fans, John discovered the blues by working backward.
I was a rock and roll freak at art school, and I had a friend who was a blues freak. So he turned me on to blues. You know, and he was the same age as me, and he understood rock and roll. He knew what Elvis and Fats Domino and Little Richard were all about. But he said, how about this? You know, have you heard, this is where that came from. And I thought, oh, that's where rock and roll. It didn't take my love from rock and roll away. And it also added blues to my consciousness, the real blues.
Mid-50s Liverpool kids who loved black American music owed a debt to the sailors who docked there. The Swabbies helped keep the locals tuned in to the latest in rock and roll, blues, and soul.
The sailors would bring it in. We were hearing old funky blues records in Liverpool that people across Britain or Europe had never even heard because people didn't know about them, only the port areas.
Like the blues as opposed to jazz, you know, white, middle class, good jazz, as opposed to the blues, you know. The blues is better because it's real, you know, it's like... It's not perverted or thought about in a... It's not a concept. It is an actual... It's a chair, not a design for a chair, or a better chair, or a bigger chair, or a chair with leather, or with
with design. It is the first chair. You know, it's chairs for sitting on.
Yes.
Not chairs for looking at or being appreciated. You know, you sit on that music.
Now here is John doing McKinley Morganfield, better known as Muddy Waters.
Muddy, baby. It's a fire. I had something in my pocket. Keep a lot of folks alive. And now my name, age 53. I can't get it up at all. I'm tied to a tree. Oh. I woke up this morning, went right back to sleep. I woke up this evening, couldn't find my feet. But now I'm Maine, age 21. And you know, baby, we have lots and lots of fun.
Getting down at the Dakota, Sleepy Blind Lemon Lennon with his version of the Muddy Waters classic, I'm a Man. Now for an encore, here's John at home doing Chuck Berry's Brown-Eyed Handsome Man. And as you can hear, it's pretty easy to trace John's rock and roll roots directly from blues to Berry, from Berry to the Beatles.
Coming up on the Lost Lennon Tapes, John talks about his seafaring father, Freddie.
Don't go away now. We'll be back in just a minute.
100 Ventures.
Let's get back to the Lost Lennon tapes.
All the little boys and girls.
Our lives as adults are shaped to one extent or another by what our family lives were like as kids, and certainly John was no different. It's no secret that he was deeply affected by his father Alfred's desertion. By being raised under the wing of his stern yet kind-hearted Aunt Mimi, and by his free-spirited mother, Julia, being more like a friend to him than a parent. John's relationship with his father was something he didn't often talk about. It was as painful, but of course for entirely different reasons, as his mother's death when he was 17. But thanks to Aunt Mimi, ironically, we can fill in a few of the blanks about John's father. I say ironically because Mimi never liked him. You see, during the early 70s, Mimi helped research her family's history, and at John's request, she put it on a tape and sent it to him in New York City. So, with a little help from Aunt Mimi, we're going to find out a bit more about John's father, Alfred. Alf, as she calls him, or Freddie, as he's best known to us. And along the way, we'll add to our understanding of the man John came to be.
Alfred Lennon married Julia Stanley. He was born the 14th of December 1912, and Julia was born on the 12th of March 1914. And, of course, they produced John Winston Lennon, who married Cynthia, daughter of Charles Edwin Powell. Married the 23rd of August 1962 at South Liverpool.
Mary Elizabeth Stanley, John's Aunt Mimi, was Julia's older sister. When Julia was about 14 and working at the local cinema, she met a young office clerk named Alfred Lennon. And when she started bringing him around the Stanley home in Wavertree, her family grilled her about him.
When we used to see this scruffy little fellow hanging around, we asked who he was and what she was doing with him, you know, the usual family talk. And she was trying to explain him away, sort of thing. She said, you know, he didn't always live down at Copperfield Street. At least his father didn't. He used to live in Mulberry Street. Well, that is a slightly better area than the one that he went to live in. He wasn't very far from Ringo's people, as a matter of fact.
Alfred was 9 when his father died of a liver ailment. When the younger Lennon was 16, he left the clerk's job and signed up as a ship's waiter, going off to sea on the first of his many voyages. Between trips, Alfred often stayed with the Stanleys. He was the one who taught Julia to play banjo, and Julia would later teach John what she knew. Ultimately, it was Julia who suggested that she and Alfred go ahead and tie the knot on December 3rd, 1938. They'd been married a bit less than 2 years when John was born, October 9th, 1940. Alf was at sea once again, then working as a steward on troop and merchant ships crossing the Atlantic. He drank a lot and was often in trouble. Alfred and Julia finally split up for good in spring 1942. Alfred Lennon didn't show up at Men Love Avenue again until 1945, when he attempted to take John, age 5, to New Zealand. But Julia confronted Alfred, and John was forced to choose between his mother and father. John chose his dad at first, but when Julia got up to leave, he ran after her instead. Julia then took him back to her sister Mimi and her husband George at 251 Men Love Avenue, where John spent the rest of his formative years.
I never saw him again until I made a lot of money and he came back. Which is another story altogether.
I got a chip on my shoulder that's bigger than my feet. I can't talk to people that I meet. If I could see you now, I'd try to make you sad somehow, but I can't talk right instead.
By 1964, Alfred had left the sea and was laboring as a porter at the Greyhound Hotel, not too far from the mansion in Weybridge where John and Cynthia were living. A local newspaper reporter tracked Alf down and...
I opened the Daily Express and there he was, washing dishes in a small hotel or something very near to where I was living in the stockbroker belt outside of London.
When Alfred managed to get onto the Hard Day's Night set, John, instead of seeing his father, got his address, then began sending him the sum of £12 a week.
He was blackmailing me. He'd been writing to me to try and get in contact. I didn't want to see him. I was too upset about it all that he would turn up when I was rich and famous and not bothered to turn up before. So I wasn't going to see him at all, but he sort of blackmailed me in the press where he keeps saying, I'm a poor man washing dishes while he's living in luxury, and I fell for it and saw him, and we had some kind of relationship.
With the new weekly paycheck from his son, Alfred moved into a new flat and enjoyed his newfound celebrityhood as the Beatle dad who returned from sea. He and John saw each other occasionally, much to Aunt Mimi's dismay.
You were very kind to Alfred Lennon, taking him round the West End and having him in your home. I don't suppose it ever once crossed your mind that that would hurt me.
Well, Alfred eventually even got a manager named Tony Cartwright, and the two of them wrote a song together. So, in December 1965, at the age of 53... Alfred Freddie Lennon made his first and only record titled That's My Life, My Love, and My Home.
I'll pick up my story where I once left off. I sailed with the tides and lived on dreams. I've watched the sunrise over every ocean.
That's my life, that's my love and my home.
It started in Liverpool, where I was born. No father to advise me, but I carried on. First time I saw the sea, I just knew this had to be.
That's my life, that's my love, and my home.
I must tell you this, I was no heartbreaker, perhaps a dream maker. But as the years rolled by, I saw a lifetime of love go wrong. Pity was my partner all along. Yet listen to me, just let me tell you, now I've grown strong. It could be the end of my story, but my story will never end. Because people have always told me I've been a true friend, with little to give, but a heart to lend.
That's my life, that's my love, and my home.
I'll make no excuses for my own abuses, because life makes us all that way. I could blame the cruel sea for taking away from me.
That's my life, that's my love, and my home. That's my life, that's my love, and my home.
That was my life, my love, and my home.
From late 1965, John's father, Alfred Freddie Lennon, with his one and only single, That's My Life, My Love, and My Home.
He married a secretary of that had been working for me or the Beatles, age 22, and had a child, which I thought was hopeful for a man who'd lived a life of a drunk and almost a Bowery bum. But a lot of his life was spent like that.
Now, going through primal therapy in 1970 had made John realize how much anger he still felt for his father. So at that point, John acrimoniously broke off the relationship. Speaking with John on the first day of 1976, I asked him if he had any regrets about his life so far. He said two. The first was not being able to regain custody of Kyoko, Yoko's daughter by her first marriage. That's another story altogether. And secondly, having thrown his father out after the primal experience. Have you heard from him since?
No, because I tried to write to his lawyer, but I didn't get to. I don't really care if I never do get through. You know, I regret it, and if he ever turns up, I will be reasonable again. But those are only two things, you know. I'd like to clear them up before I died, and maybe, you know, that's about all. There's a long time to go, so, you know, there's no hurry.
I know there is, John.
Before he dies would be nice, too, because he's older than me.
But it wasn't to be. 3 months to the day after that interview, on April 1st, 1976, Alfred Freddie Lennon died of cancer at Brighton General Hospital, England. He was 63.
Coming up, Beyond the Sea with Ethel Merman, or Another Voyage into the Dakota Zone. It's Anchors Away once again on the Lost Lennon Tapes. Let's return to the Lost Lennon Tapes.
Mighty's no way you've heard the last of John C.'s stories. He has a treasure chest full of them. Here's another barnacle-encrusted artifact from deep in the Dakota's Davy Jones locker.
"'Twas a night like Ethel Merman, not a sailor in the sky, a kind of aged gentleman was giving me a try. I remember it distinctly, as clear as yesterday. I was excavating mucus, and I thought I heard him say, "Oh, timorous beastly, wa oor the briny sea, the noo is oot the brocken, the moochlick dinna tree. It's a long way to Tipperillo, Hawkeye. Mine eye was clouded o'er as I heard his mournful song. I asked him what the time was. He said it wasn't long."
And somehow, that serves as the perfect intro for this mad musical medley, which leads off with John's left-of-left-bank parody of Beyond the Sea in fractured French.
"Bonsoir, madame et monsieur. Comment allez-vous? Je me lève à 7h aujourd'hui. Le pomme de terre, Alice Cooper. Mon les chansons, les ébogards. La mer, tu les enfuis. J'aime c'est mon tempo. On s'est conçus sans l'envie. Ah, s'il va mourir à la mer. Mon mon Dieu, mon Dieu, mon Dieu. Tous les mots avec yeux et mon chevaux, mon château, mon tasse de thé, mon étendard. La mer, mon chou, tous les sens, ma zoo, c'est là mon chant. On s'éprend tous les ongles qui la subordonnent. Oh, merde, enchanté. Mon chien, c'est bon. On sait les prendre, ne les prendre du tout. Ma chérie, ma popo, mon little popo. Do you remember when we were in the cafe and you left me? You could not find your gutter because it was around your little throat, you naughty little Sherry. Thank heaven for little pearls. Yourself, you get yourself diseased. La la la. Blue moon, you'll be standing alone without a dog or a bone. Without a reasonable chance of recovery. They say for every boy and girl, there's just one love in this whole world, and I found mine, boy, I found mine. Oh, this is thrilling. Just one kiss from your sweet lips tells me no one can ever split your P's or Q's or African shipping. Bum, bum, bum. Diddly-diddly-boom.
John in his music room at the Dakota, serenading us with a medley of favorites from the 50s. He started out with a French parody of Beyond the Sea, segued into Blue Moon, and closed the set with Young Love.
Thank you, thank you, thank you. It's wonderful. Thank you, thank you. No, no, really, really, next time I'll wear pants.
Well, as John puts his pants back on, it's time for us to sail on out of here. Hope you enjoyed the excursion into the Dakota Triangle. My sentiments exactly. Looking forward to shipping out with you again next time. For the Lost Lennon Tapes, I'm Elliot Mintz.
The Lost Lennon Tapes, brought to you by Snickers. At home, work, or play, Snickers really satisfies. The Lost Lennon Tapes, a presentation of the Westwood One Radio Network in cooperation with the John Lennon Estate. Written and produced by Stephen Peoples. Production and engineering by Dave Kephart, with pre-production assistance by Jeff Kowalczyk, Ray Klein, and Brian Schiff. Production coordinator, Steve Longo. Research consultant, Mark Lewison. Special thanks to
Dr. DeLanto.
Our executive producer, Norm Pattis. And for Westwood One, I'm Scott Muni. Thanks for tuning in.